Blog Talk Radio.
Peace and blessings. Welcome to the Black Womaniverse. This is your host, Seek Wisdom. Today is, what is today's date? Today is May the 20th? Yeah, May the 20th, Thursday, May the 20th. And tonight we will be discussing What Does It Really Mean, Part 2. If you missed Part 1, make sure that you go back and listen to the show that we did on Part 1. That show we did on April 22nd, What Does It Really Mean? And this is a Part 2 to that show. And pretty much we're going to be going through the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets by Barbara G. Walker. And in that book, we're going to get into a lot of words and terminologies that we've heard before, but we may not necessarily know the origins of those words and what do they really mean. So this is a chance for the sisters to come on in. You know, class is now in session where we can sit and dialogue with each other about the information that, you know, that will be coming forward tonight. So, again, make sure you go back and listen to Part 1 if you have missed Part 1. BlackWomaniverse.com is open and available for the sisters. Again, BlackWomaniverse.com. So if you are not a part or a member of that site, you need to go ahead to BlackWomaniverse.com and sign up and become a member of that site. We have lots of sisters over there, and we give out information that is exclusive to BlackWomaniverse.com. So you want to make sure that you're signed up so that you will get all of the books that we go through there, the discussions, the forums, the chats, and that you're invited to our private temple calls and things of that nature. So, again, go sign up, BlackWomaniverse.com. If you want to reach us here at Black Womaniverse, our toll-free number is 1-877-522-2653, and we are at extension 5. I do want to let everyone know we do have a summer retreat coming up for Black Womaniverse. This will be our second retreat. We had one in the spring. If you want to hear about that one, you can go back and listen to a show called Goddess Gathering and a show called Spring Equinox Retreat. So you can get some details on, you know, things we wanted to do for the spring retreat and then hear from a few of the sisters that actually participated with the retreat. The summer retreat will be on July 23rd through July 25th, and it will be here in Richmond. If you are a part of the site, blackwomaniverse.com, you can go under events and get the details on that. But you can also email us if you have any questions and or comments. Our email address is blackwom@divinechemistry.com, and chemistry is spelled K-H-E-M-E-S-T-R-Y. Before we go any further, we're going to go ahead and get some music going while we open up the chat room and get everyone situated in the chat room. And we'll be right back.
So tell it. Thank you. all over town, but you can't make a run around. Fly, baby, that's fine with me. I need to know, is you feeling me? Oh, can you take your picture?
This is Tanya K. Freeman, affectionately called Diva Mama Tanya, and I'd love for you to join me and my beloved on a retreat cruise to the Bahamas the weekend of October 29th and November 1st. Celebrate awakening the diva within. Enjoy life-changing seminars and belly dance rituals on Coco Cay Island. Invite your significant other to participate in embracing the sacred masculine. Then, join us again as we share our views on the beauty and the power of sacred intimacy. Contact Alicia at 877-227-5184 or visit wombshaman.com. That's WOMBSHAMAN.com. Relax. Renew, refresh on this extraordinary journey.
All right, peace and blessings, and you are listening live to Black Womaniverse Radio. This is your host, Seek Wisdom, and wow, tonight we are doing What Does It Really Mean, Part 2? And again, we are going to be reading some information from Barbara G. Walker's The Woman's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets. And, of course, we are going to look through the lenses of the original goddess while we're doing so. I do have some sisters on the line, so I will be opening up some lines so the sisters can, add in to the conversation and the information that I'm sharing tonight. First line I will be opening, let me see if Sister Earth is ready. I don't know if she is. Let's check. Peace, sis. How are you?
Peace. I'm here.
All right. Are you you want me to mute your line back out, or are you cool with the line being open right now?
I'm cool with the line being open.
Okay. All right. And we're waiting on Pastor Flowers. We need, we need the triple goddesses or the triple reverends in the house. Come on, call in, Pastor Flowers, 646-716-7675. All right, let's see here. We touched on a lot of information in What Does It Really Mean, Part 1. Again, as I said earlier, if you missed part one, you want to go back to the show. It's dated April 22nd. All right, so make sure you go back and listen to that if you have not already. And there is Pastor Flowers. How you doing, Pastor Flowers?
Hi, how are you all? I'm blessed.
I'm great. Great. All right, we're going to go ahead and dive on into some of this information tonight. And our sisters in the chat room and the sisters on the line, if you have a comment or question on anything that we are touching on or speaking on at the moment, please feel free to call. Our call-in number is 646-716-7675. Again, as always, This is an interactive show, so if you have a comment or question, feel free. Don't be shy. You know, you can put it in the chat room, but it would be nice if we could hear you as well. Let's see. I think I'm going to start with a very appropriate word, and I can't believe I didn't touch on this in the first one, but very appropriate. I'm going to go into the womb. We need to know what a womb is. What do you think about that, Pastor Flowers?
That would be great, because we need to learn everything. We really just need to go over everything and retrace, because there's things that we just don't know.
Okay. I want to give a shout-out to everyone who is in the chat room. I see Jade08 from the UK, live and direct pieces. Thanks for joining us tonight. Memphis, Seychat, Sister Shannon, Street Wax, that's Sister Earth, Super Seer, Darrell, and, of course, Pastor Flowers and the guests we have in the chat room. Just want to give a shout-out to everyone. And for our listeners who may be listening to us on Facebook, please feel free to come on over to blackwomaniverse.com. I'm sorry. Well, yeah, you can join blackwomaniverse.com. But come on over to participate and listen and, chat it up with everyone who's in the chat room. You can find us at Blackwomaniverse. You can find us at blogtalkradio.com/blackwomaniverse. So come on over and have a conversation with us here live and direct in the chat room. All right, let's go ahead and start off with the womb. Womb. The Sanskrit word for any temple or sanctuary was garbhagra, which meant womb. The great annual festival of Aphrodite in Argos was called Hysteria, which meant womb. The oldest oracle in Greece, sacred to the great mother of earth, sea, and sky, was named Delphi from Delphos, which meant womb. Megalithic tomb and burial mounds were designed as wombs to give rebirth to the dead. Their vaginal entrance passages shows that Neolithic folk went to considerable trouble to devise imitations of female anatomy in earth and stone. Tomb and womb were even related linguistically. Greek tumbos and Latin tumulus were cognates of tumere, to swell, to be pregnant. The word tummy is thought to have come from the same root. Womb temple and womb tombs point backward to the matriarchal age, when only feminine life magic was thought efficacious. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that word correctly. Rebirth from the womb and tomb was the meaning of the doomed funerary stupa of the Far East, where the remains of the sainted dead lay within a structure called garba, the womb. The parallel with burrow graves, Mycenaean Tholos tombs, caves, temples, and other such structures is now well known. Even a Christian cathedral centered on the space called nave, originally meaning belly. Caves and burial chambers were said to be sunk into the bowels of the earth, that is, of Mother Earth. The biblical term for birth is separation from the bowels, or separation from the womb. Archetypal womb symbolism is as common today as it ever was, though not always recognized as such. Paul Klee said, and I quote, "Which artist would not wish to dwell at the central organ of all motion, from which all functions derive their life? In the womb of nature and the primal ground of creation, where the secret key to all things lies hidden." Does anyone have anything to add to that?
Well, everything from the atmosphere, everything in life is a replica of that womb. You know, everything from the house we live in, all of that, you know, understood from the concept of being in those primordial waters of the womb. So there are many different things, like you were saying, like the churches. I mean, I learned things by way of the Bible. And so the whole church building and different parts of the church and just the way they set up the pews, all of that represented the woman's womb.
Indeed. Now, you just said house and home, and that is on my list.
Mm-hmm.
And we just learned that his, we mentioned hysteria in reading information regarding the womb. And so we know that hysteria was related to the womb as well. So I'm going to see if I can touch on both of those words next. Let's see. Interesting. I don't see house. Maybe they have home in here.
Well, they might, you know, because like Jerusalem or Bethlehem meant house. So they might be under something different than just, say, the English word house. It might have some other.
And I do know the Medunetter or Kemetic word for house was per. Per or however one would pronounce it. But that also meant home or house. All right, I'm going to go ahead and read on hysteria since we mentioned that just a few moments ago. I know it's a very short explanation for that word. It simply means womb.
Mm-hmm.
The orgiastic religious, and this is what they have in here, the orgiastic religious festival of Aphrodite in Argos, where the womb of the world was adored and symbolically fructified. Hysteria was given its present meaning by Renaissance doctors who explains women's diseases with a theory that the womb sometimes became detached from its place and wandered about inside the body, causing uncontrolled behavior. Yeah, that's a bit laughable, the last part. All right, so we are going to go from there to the word hymen, because I don't know if a lot of people really have gotten into that word now. It's a lot of information I could touch on with hymen, but I'm not going to go where I really want to go because we're going to save that for womb biology and genetics, and we're going to get into the real good stuff. All right, so hymen here means the veil of the temple.
Repeat
the anatomical,
that again.
The veil of the temple.
The veil. Okay.
The veil.
Mm-hmm.
The anatomical definition descended from a concept of the vagina as a sanctuary of Aphrodite, the virgin goddess, presiding over defloration. Mm-hmm. The veil of her temple was, quote unquote, rent in the mist. And that comes from Luke 23:45.
Correct.
By the passion of her doomed bridegroom at the moment where he entered her Tithonian womb and the sun was darkened, all clements borrowed by the Christian crucifixion myths, and it's referring to honey. So we'll go to the word honey next. At the sacred marriage as well as the secular marriages, the goddess was invoked with the cry, O hymen, hymene, possible origins of the word hymn, like you sing hymns in the church.
It is.
Okay. All right, well, let's go to honey since it referred us to honey so we can find out some information regarding that.
I got a honey love in the chat room.
Yeah, I've seen it. Peace, honey. And peace to Ja in the chat room at P71. I see you out there. Just want to say peace and blessings to you. All right, honey. Being one of the few preservatives the ancients knew along with salt, honey was widely regarded as a substance of resurrection magic. In Asia Minor, from 3500 to 1750 BC, the dead were embalmed in honey and placed in the fetal positions in burial vases or pithoi ready for rebirth. To feel into a jar of honey, quote-unquote, became a common metaphor for, quote-unquote, to die. The pithos represented the womb of the goddess under her name Pandora. Now they're talking about Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm.
All giver, quote-unquote, and honey became her sacred essence. Myths present many symbolic assurances that the goddess would restore life to the dead through her magic bee balm. Worshippers of Demeter or Diana called her the pure mother bee, and her Tesmorphia festivals displayed honey cakes shaped like female genitals. The symbol of Aphrodite at Erex was a golden honeycomb. Her priestess bore the name Melissa, which meant queen bee. the same as the Jewish queen Deborah, priestess of Asherah, whose name also meant bee. The bee was rightly looked upon as a symbol of the feminine potency of nature. In the Syracusan Thesmoria, the participants carry Maloi cakes made of honey and sesame in the shape of the female sex organ. Menzel draws an apt parallel between this custom and the Hindu usage of daubing the woman's genital with honey at the marriage feast. Bees are still called hymenoptera, billed wings, after the hymen or veil that covered the inner sanctum of the goddess's temple, the veil having its physical counterpart in the woman's body. Defloration was a ritual penetration of the veil under the hymeneal rules of the goddess. Her self-entitled hymen is in the character of patroness of the wedding night and honeymoon. Mm-hmm. The honeymoon spanned a lunar month, usually in May, the month of pairings, named after the goddess as the Virgin Maya. In an archaic period, sacred kings seem to have been destroyed after a 28-day honeymoon with the goddess, spanning a lunar cycle as the queen bee destroys her drone bridegroom by tearing out his genitals. Ooh, wow. As applied to ordinary weddings rather than sacrificial dramas, the honeymoon of a lunar month, which include a menstrual period, the real source of what the euphemistically called moon honey. A bridegroom contacted the source of life by copulating with his bride during menstruation. According to the oldest Oriental belief, even the great god Shiva was helpless unless his phallus was baptized in the blood from the vagina of Kali Maya, his Shakti and mother in the tantric ritual known as Maharuti. A combination of honey and menstrual blood was once considered the universal elixir of life, the nectar, manufactured by Aphrodite and her sacred bees, which kept the very gods alive. Similarly, the great secret of Norse mythology was that the gods' nectar of wisdom, inspiration, literacy, magic, and eternal life was a combination of honey and wise blood from the great cauldron in the belly of the Mother Earth. Though the late patriarchal revision claimed the hydromel or honey liquid was a mixture of honey with the blood of a male sacrificial victim known as the wisest of men. Even the most patriarchal cults seem unable to dispense with the life-giving feminine fluids. Celibate priests of Mithra who excluded women from their temples nevertheless worshipped the moon goddess Diana or Luna, who, quote-unquote, made the honey which was used in the purifications. Of course, it was the moon goddess who also made the wise blood of female lunar cycles. Porphyry preferred a popular belief in his day that bees were reincarnations of the lunar nymphs. Phoenician myths speak of hero Lemminkainen torn to pieces like a sacrificial victim and sent to Manala, the underground realm of the death goddess Mana. His other mother restored him to life with her magic honey, assisted by her familiar spirit, Mahalinian and the bee. Early Christian Orphites celebrated a tantric-style love feast, which included the tasting of menstrual blood, and it was said of them that they mingled blood with honey. Thus, they combined two of three substances, the third being salt, most often associated with resurrection or birth or rebirth. Now, the thing I just mentioned about them speaking about salt being the third, you honey, menstrual blood, and salt, it's funny that to this day, when people want to use a ritual cleansing bath, they use salt. Mm-hmm. When you want to make holy water, you use salt.
Because the sea is salt, and so is that
exactly
that fluid inside her.
Exactly. All right.
Someone said you lost them. I'm not sure.
I don't know if they were talking to me or someone else in the chat room. So.
I see.
Okay. All right. So let's see. I'm going to. Did we speak on Vesica Pisces last time? Because I have that on my list, but I think we spoke about that last time. Did we?
You might need to refresh because I don't remember you saying anything about it.
Okay. Okay. Visica Pisces. Now, this is a symbol that was turned sideways, and it was like that fish symbol they use for a Christian symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And they used it as a Pisces symbol as well, but it's actually supposed to be upside down, just like a yoni, just like a vagina. Vesica Pisces, the vessel of the fish, a common yonic or yonic symbol, the pointed oval named from the ancients, claimed that female genitals smelled like fish.
Mm-hmm.
Mother Kali herself appeared in a Hindu story as a virgin named Fishy Smell, whose real name was Truth, like the god, Egyptian goddess Ma'at. Egyptians said Abtu, the abyss, was a fish who swallowed the penis of Osiris, but this abyss was also the fish of Isis, therefore a sexual metaphor. Aphrodite's principal rites at Paphos took place under the sign of Pisces, the fish. Aphrodite, Isis, Freya, and other forms of the goddess in a sexual aspect appear veiled in fishnets. And it's referring you to fish and Sheila Nagig. The Vesica Pisces was an unequivocal genital sign of the Sheila Nagig figures of old Irish churches. The squatted, naked goddess displayed her vulva as Vesica, as did the temple door images of Kali in India. Mm-hmm. One of the old pagan ideograms of sexual union was adopted by the church to represent the feast of St. Nicholas on the runic calendar, a Vesica Pisces enveloping a male furca. The pointed oval fish sign was even used by early Christians to represent the mystery of God's union with his mother bride, which is why Jesus was called the little fish in the Virgin's fountain. This female enclosure was much used in Christian art, especially as a superimposition on Mary's belly with her child within. Sometimes Christ at his ascension was shown rising into a heavenly vesica as if returning to the mother symbol. I'm going to pause there because almost every picture where they show Jesus ascending, he's going into this yoni symbol, which is a vesica Pisces, with the Mother Mary waiting for him inside of it.
You acting like you were before.
I can't hear you that well.
That ain't right.
I still can't hear you.
Randy, you and Trump.
Okay. Another name for...
Exactly what I mean.
This female enclosure, hold on, I think I lost my place, y'all. Okay. Another name for the same sign was mandorla or almond, which also represented a yoni. In the cult of the Magna Mater, an almond was the feminine conception charm for the virgin birth of Attis. I think we lost Pastor Flowers. Hopefully she will call back in a few moments. I am going to open up our caller from the 478 area code just in case she has anything to add, because I know who this is. Peace, sis.
Girl, I'm dining.
That's all right. I can put you
I'm dining listening to y'all, honey. I'm in dining mode.
I thought you were like you were eating. I was like, I'll put you back on mute.
No, eating what y'all throwing out. But now I have a picture. It's a nice picture, though, and then I'll let you finish. But it's a very older picture of Callie sitting with her legs wide open. But, no, I'm dining, so put me back off.
Okay. All right, will do. All right. Okay, let's see. I know I mentioned a word I wanted to go back to when I was going through Vesica Pisces. So let me. Oh, cowrie. We're talking about symbolism. Let's go to the cowrie because I don't know if everyone knows what the cowrie means, what the cowrie symbolizes. And, you know, we speak a lot about that when you're looking at African tradition and things of that nature. We go back to the cowrie, and the cowrie was sacred to every goddess culture, specifically Africans and Asians, but and the Indus Kush, you know, the pretty much all over the East, the cowrie was sacred. So I'm going to go pull that up so we can look into that and seek some clarification on that. All right. Okay, cowrie. Its name derived from Kauri, K-A-U-R-I, who is the same as Kali, Kunti, Yoni of the universe. The Kauri shell everywhere represented the divine vulva and usually conveyed the idea of rebirth. Skeletons from the Solutrean period, circa 20,000 B.C., have been found lavishly decorated with cowrie shells. Egyptians decorated sarcophagi with cowrie shells as a rebirth charm. Cowries are still prized throughout the East for their supposed healing and regenerative powers. Cowrie necklaces are valued in India as amulets against the evil eye. Muslim women believe cowries should be worn on the body during pregnancy. The Japanese keep cowries in wardrobe cabinets for good luck. If no cowries are available, pornographic pictures of the female genitals serve as a substitute. Gypsies valued a cowrie above all other kinds of protective amulets. Christianized natives of the Sudan consider a strip of leather stamped with the sign of the cross a valuable amulet, but it is not strong magic unless the 9 cowrie shells are attached to it. There's that number 9. Romans called the cowrie shell matriculus, little matrix, symbol of the alma mater, or soul mother, or teaching priestess, which is why a student still matriculates into instruction. The Roman alma mater taught the philosophy of love as well as the love of philosophy, unlike Christians. The pagans believed the capacity for heterosexual love required careful nurture and training. Sometimes the Roman called a cowrie porcella, little soul, because it stood for the goddess who was the great soul, like or great soul like Demeter, Astarte, Ceres, Freya, Ceridwen, etc. From porcella came porcelain, so called because of its resemblance to the white glazed surface of the shell. A Greek word for cowrie was kitis, which also meant a scallop, a comb, and a vulva. The extreme antiquity of cowrie symbolism in the Middle East is shown by the ancestor skulls preserved by the people of Jericho in the 7th millennium B.C. These forerunners of the Jewish teraphim were severed from the body, provided with features of painted plaster, and made to see with the eyes of cowrie shells. Speaking of the Melanesians and Polynesians' reverence for cowries, a missionary, Reverend George Brown, wrote, and I quote, there is some sacredness about them, but what it is not all clear. The natives would not talk about them at all. It seems likely that the natives he mentioned had already become well aware that there was no use of talking about sexual symbols to missionaries. Yes, yes, yes. That is what the cowrie is all about. Some of the information pertaining to the cowrie. Okay. The next word I'm going to touch on is Amazon. Now, I know Kendra is going to have some things she wants to add later about Amazons, because I'm sure she could bless us with some of her knowledge on Amazons. We're going to see what the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets speaks about in reference to Amazons. All right. As soon as I can find this word in here. Y'all, this is a really thick book, so sometimes it takes me a minute to find things. All right. Okay, here it is. Ooh, this is like 3 or 4 pages, so I'm going to try to scan and read the bulk of it, but I'm probably not going to be able to read all of it. Amazons, a Greek name for goddess-worshipping tribes in North Africa. Anatolia and the Black Sea area. Due to an erroneous belief that Amazon warriors destroyed the right breast to be unhindered in drawing the bow, some derive the name from Amazos, breastless, but Greek representations of Amazon show no such mutilation. The idea many have arisen from Asiatic icons of the primal androgen with a male right half and female left half echoed by a coalescence of the Amazon goddess Artemis with her brother consort Apollo. Scholars now say that the word Amazon meant moon woman. Suetonius said Amazons once ruled over a large part of Asia as late as the 5th century A.D. The Black Sea was still known as the Amazon Sea. Libya, which used to mean all of North Africa except Egypt, was also Amazonian. Herodotus spoke of Libyan Amazons. Diodorus, 1st century Greek historian, called them the warlike women of Libya. To this day, North African Berbers call themselves Amazigh, though their common name came from the Latin Barbary, barbarians. The ancients said Amazons were the first to tame horses, which may well account for their army's legendary invincibility. In open country, mounted troops, whether male or female, would have a decided advantage over foot soldiers. In Amazonian myths, the goddess was often worshipped as a mare. India's mare mother, Serenayu, mare-headed Demeter, or Cretan, I am chopping these words up, so I'm sorry, or Cretan Leukippe, it's spelled L-E-U-K-I-P-P-E, the quote-unquote white mare, M-A-R-E, whose priests were castrated and wore female dresses. Among Scythians also, men entered the service of the goddess by castrating themselves and adopting women's clothing. The only deity shown in Scythian art was the great goddess whom the Greeks called Artemis, Hestia or Gaia, which is earth. Some of the Scythians settled in Parthia, virgin land, named after their goddess. They came to be known as Sakae, and that's spelled S-A-C-A-E, and their chief city was Sekistan, now Sistian, or Sistian, it's spelled S-E-I-S-T-A-N, Sistan. Scythians were governed by priestess queens, usually buried alone in rich furnished kurgans, which were queen graves. 5 kurgans were discovered together in southern Russia in 1954. Scythian priestess were elder women old enough to have gray hair. They performed traditional sacrifices, catching the blood in sacred cauldrons and taking omens from the entrails. They also accompanied their armies into battles to cast spells for victory. The moon sickle used in mythical castrations of gods was a Scythian weapon. A long-handled form therefore came to be called Geis, and was assigned to the Grim Reaper, who was originally Rhea, Cronia, in the guise of Mother Time or Mother Death, the earth who devoured her own children. Okay, I'm going to pause there, because we all hear about Father Time, but rarely do you hear time referred to as Mother Time, and it does directly correlate to the goddess Rhea or Cronia. But you hear about Kronos all the time, which is the male god of time, but a lot of people don't know that Kronos is Cronia. But I guess we can touch on that some other time. Scythian women apparently used such weapons in battle as well as in religious ceremonies and agriculture. Diodorus said Scythian women fight like men and are nowise inferior to them in bravery. A Scythian girl was allowed to marry only after she had killed 3 enemies in battle. It was unusual for barbarian armies to include women. Feminine magic powers was often considered necessary for victory. The Bible says Barak commanded an army of 10,000 men but refused to go into battle unless the priestess queen Deborah went along or Deborah went along to cast victory spells for him. Tacitus told of Druidic forces repelling Roman invaders on the island of Mona, or Moon, in 61 A.D. Among the soldiers, black-clad women waved swords and cursed the enemies like the Furies. Greek myth says Amazon tribes occupied Cappadocia, Samothrace, and Lesbos and founded the cities of Smyrna, Ephesus, Thymes, Marine, and Paphos, all leading centers of goddess worship. Amazons came to the aid of matriarchal Troy in the Trojan War. The Amazon queens fell beneath the sword of Achilles, who immediately violated her dead body. Okay, the Amazon queen they're referring to is Penthesilea. Homer attributed this necrophilic act to Achilles' love of her beautiful corpse. Okay, I want to pause there because the Sibyls, the first prophetess of Mamiwata, that book speaks about the war in Troy, and it speaks about the Amazons and this particular situation in reference to the necrophilic act, the Achilles having sex with a dead Amazon. You know, so there's other literature out there that speaks about this information as well. Okay, I think that is all I'm going to read on Amazon for the moment. Let me check on Goddess Networks and see if she has any comments or anything she wants to add on the Amazons. All right, sis, your line is open. Did you have anything you want to add about the Amazons?
No, you did. You summed it up well.
Okay. All right. All right. I'm going to touch on another word that I've heard. I know people named by this flower or plant, and it's myrtle, M-Y-R-T-L-E. So let me find it, because when I found out what that word actually meant, I was like, okay. And now would be the time I can't find it. Is it myrtle spelled M-Y-R, or is it M-R-Y? Well, I can't get this word right. I may have to come back to that one. Okay. I'll come back to myrtle, but I will touch on Hathor. Actually, you know what? I need to go back to androgen, because we just finished reading about Amazons. So I'm going to go back to androgen, because that word came up when we were reading about Amazons. Okay. Androgen. Many Indo-European religions try to combine male and female in the primal androgen, both sexes in one body, often with two heads and four arms. Okay, I cannot pronounce this word. Brahadaranyaka. Wow, some of these Sanskrit words really are hard to pronounce, but I'll try. Brahadaranyaka Upandish said the primal androgen was one of the same size and kind as man and woman closely embracing. Some said the male and female elements live together in one skin, experiencing constant sexual bliss and spiritual completeness. Shiva and Shakti Kali appeared as the androgen Adhanarasvara, the right side male and the left side female. Rudra, the older form of Shiva, was known as the Lord who is half woman. Brahma and Vishnu also appeared as bisexual beings united with their Shaktis. Chinese Taoists held the mandala of yang and yin to represent the androgen. Western myth also assigned androgyny to the elder gods or the first human beings. The Orphic creation myth said the firstborn deity was a double-sex pains or eros, which meant carnal love, whose female half was Psyche, the soul, Greek equivalent of Shakti. Hermes owed his phenomenal wisdom to his former androgynous existence with mother Aphrodite as double-sex hermaphroditus. Often the androgen appeared in myth as male-female twins born simultaneously. Example, Isis, Osiris, Janus, Diana, Dionysus. Fauna, Faunus, Helen, Helenus, Artemis, Apollo, the moon and the sun, united in their mother's womb. Probably an androgynous image on Apollo's altar at Delos gave rise to the story that he copulated with his sister Artemis on that altar. Several forms of the sun god were represented as requiring close physical union with the moon goddess, as even Brahma was useless without his female counterpart, Bravani, which means being. Egypt's supreme sun god was often an androgyn. The sun was his right eye and the moon his left. The same androgynous being is still worshipped in Dahomey as Nana Baluko, moon sun, who created the world and gave birth to the first pair of human beings. I'm going to repeat that last part. The same androgynous being is still worshipped in Dahomey as Nana Baluko, moon sun, who created the world and gave birth to the first pair of human beings. Many myths model the first human beings on Earth, the first human beings on the androgen. Persians said the first pair in the Garden of Eden lived together in one body until Ahura Mazda separated them. I'm sorry, y'all, I lost my place. I'm sorry for my little silent pauses here. I was trying to check the chat room, so I apologize. Jewish imitators of the Persians also said Adam and Eve were united in a bisexual body. Some rabbinical sources said Eve was not taken out of Adam, that they were parted from one another by a jealous God who resented their sexual bliss. Now, that's deep, but I'm going to leave that for another time. Which was too godlike for human beings. Now, I'm going to step back and repeat this again. Some rabbinical sources said Eve was not taken out of Adam. They were parted from one another by a jealous God who resented their sexual bliss, which was too godlike for human beings and should have been reserved for deities. Casting man out of the garden meant detaching him from the female body, often symbolized by the Hebrew parties, or quote-unquote garden. This was another way of saying the original sin that angered God was not disobedience, but sex. That's going to be very important to some information that people will come upon when they start really, really studying who and what the original beings were. And that's all I'm going to say. Greek myths of the Golden Age told the same tale of a jealous god, Zeus, who punished humanity's friends, Prometheus, with eternal torture because he tricked the Heavenly Father for humanity's advantage. And they're referencing the word sacrifice. The people of the Golden Age had been created androgynous by Prometheus, who made their bodies of clay, and Athene, who gave them life. Father Zeus took out his anger on them by tearing them apart. A piece of clay was torn out of the female part and stuck to the male part. This is why women have an orifice that bleeds and men have a loose dangling appendage that seems not to belong to them but always craves to return to the female body it came from. Ooh. Cruel Zeus permitted human beings to return the male appendage to its female home sometimes to sense for a brief moment the bliss of their formal bisexual existence. Okay, I'm going to have to go and read what bisexual is in this book so that we can get a clear understanding of what that word means. So hopefully that word is in this book. Some Gnostics, mystery cults of the first century AD, taught tantric techniques to prolong the moment of bliss, which angered most forms of Heavenly Father, including the Christian one, whose bishops denounced this training as schooling in wickedness. Church fathers especially deplored making or remaking the beast with two backs, another term for the primal androgen. Though Orthodox Christianity renounced both sexuality and androgyny in religious images, Gnostic Christians used them, as Kali was the female half of Shiva, so the Gnostic Great Mother Sophia was the female half of Christ. Now, this is why I keep telling people that they need to go study the Gnostic text. The Gnostic text is one of the most closest things to what the ancients taught. it's not the only thing, but it's very, very, very close. This was revealed in a great light. The Savior was shown as an androgyne coupled with Sophia, mother of all. Gnostic Christians said that those who received the true revelation of the Father, Mother, Spirit were the only ones prepared for the secret sacrament called apolytrosis, release, a concept identical with tantric moksha or liberation. Obviously influenced by tantricism or its prototype, Western Gnostics had made a direct translation of the Hindu yab yum, father, mother, which is the same as yin and yang. The sexual union of a sage and his shakti at the crucial moment of death. Sexual sacraments were in effect practicing for that moment when the enlightened one would be restored to the condition of primordial bliss as an androgynous creature. The Nicene said no enlightenment was possible without the father, mother, spirit, as androgyne, sometimes called heavenly horn of the moon. In the 5th century A.D., Orphic initiation sought to awaken a female spirit without man, to render him sensitive to the message of the mysteries. After meeting the deities in a death and rebirth experience, he carried a bow emblem of the womb and touched his belly like a graved woman, signifying a spiritual experience uniting the opposed ways of knowledge of the male and female. Infused with this idea is that of a new life conceived within. Such Gnostic subtleties were disliked by the Orthodox, who viewed all mergings of the sexes as unequivocally sinful. After Gnostic sects were crushed, the androgyne was co-signed to hell and gave birth to many curious devils with both male and female attributes. A 16th century book showed Satan himself seated on a throne wearing a papal tiara with bird feet, a female face in his genital area, and pendulous female breasts. The devil of the tarot pack was usually androgynous, as there were many of devil represented in cathedral carvings. Now, I'm going to stop there. Well, that's the end of androgyn or androgynous anyway. But on the last show entitled What Does It Mean, the first segment, we went into the devil and Devi. So I'm not going to touch on that right now because we've already touched on that. So if you want to get some information with that, again, go listen to part one, which was on April 22nd. Let's see. I knew you was going to have your hand up, sis. I knew you was going to have your hand up on that one. Kimmy, what's good, sis? I just knew it.
Well,
I'm not saying that.
I'm just resting and listening to you. But I wanted to say this for the other women or the other sisters that are, you know, really studying this stuff, to pay attention to the words that they link to other things. Like this androgyny was linked to these Amazons. And
yep.
I don't want to say too much because I think that's going to be on that show, on that private show that you talk about. But there's a reason why androgyny is linked to these Amazon women,
uh-huh.
because they were a different type of woman.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes we take for granted and just see the sisters that we see every day, and we think that these women have always looked like us. But these Amazon, they were some super women type. They were a very highly evolved women, and I'll just say this, and then I won't say nothing else.
Go
their
ahead,
genitals were not like our genitals.
No, they weren't.
I'll just say that, because that'll be on your, like, womb biology, or no, that probably would be a private call, because that goes into the anatomy and biology
two.
Of the original woman. And that's why they're linking that androgynous being to these Amazons, because their genitalia didn't look like our genitalia. It was completely different.
Now, I'm going
to
say this.
What did it look like? You don't have to get into it, but I just want to know what it looked like.
Well, I mean, in essence, if anyone paid attention to what I read, about these original deities, the original deities were a replica of the original women. And the original women had both sex organs. They were, as I read, androgynous.
They had longer clitorises.
They sure did.
And they had longer labias. Yet they were still women.
Yep. And if people go and research parthenogenesis, you can get some further detail in, because, I mean, all of these things are linked. The thing is, when people go to research and they come across something they're uncomfortable with, they stop instead of keep going. Just because it's something that we are uncomfortable with does not mean it's not true. I mean, come on now. When a lot of us found out the truth about Christianity, that shit was uncomfortable, but it was the truth. You know, so it's a lot of information out here, a lot of books. And as I said before on previous shows and conference calls and things, it's a lot of people who know the truth that are not sharing it with you. I am not telling you to believe anything I'm saying. I'm simply reading from a resource, and it is up to you that if you find something of interest or something that you think doesn't sound right, for you to go study it, because it's something that you need to know. I have a genuine interest and a genuine, I just want to know these type of things. So I'm simply sharing my journey of research to find the truth. I'm on a search for the truth as well. So, you know, again, it's a good, oh yeah, The Crone by Barbara G. Walker is a very good book. From what I hear, I haven't read that one myself, but it's on its way. Y'all know I'm always ordering books. Always ordering books. Now, I'm going to get into Hathor, the moon, and the Milky Way and midwifery. And let me check and see how much time we have. We've got about 1 hour remaining, so I'm going to go on a break right quick before I get into those things. Wow, I have a lot of words on this list, and I don't think I'm going to be able to get to them all. We can go on a brief break right quick, and we'll be right back. Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets. So that is the book that we are using as a resource today. And we are about to go through and touch on Hathor, the Milky Way and midwifery. All right, let's see. All right, I know everyone, a lot of people have heard about Hathor, the Egyptian goddess of love, fertility, you know, prosperity, abundance. But let's see what this book has to say about Hathor. Hathor, Egyptian mother of the gods and queen of heaven, originally Hethert or Heteru, the house or womb above. Later, Hethor, the house or womb of Horus. Hathor was the mother of every god and goddess. She brought forth in primeval time herself, never having been created. In the earliest dynasties, her name was a component of all royal Egyptian names, indicating the archaic matrilineal queenship based on successive incarnations of her spirit. Hathor was worshipped in Israel in the 11th century B.C. at her own holy city of Hazor, which the Old Testament claims Joshua destroyed. And that was in Joshua 11, 13, and 21. The Sinai tablets show that Hebrew workers in the Egyptian mines of Sinai about 1500 B.C. worshipped Hathor, whom they identified with the Lady of Byblos, Astarte. Some sources said there were seven Hathors, the holy midwives associated with the seven heavenly spheres. They gave each Egyptian seven souls at birth. Sevenfold Hathor entered medieval myth as the fairy godmother and mother goose, as well as the mother of the sun king, the lady of the lake, and the huntress. The upper Egypt Hathor was Sati or Satis, she of the two river banks, source of the Nile. Her destroyer aspect was a lion-headed huntress, the Sphinx, sometimes called Sekhmet or Sakhmis, the powerful. Like Kali, she drank the blood of gods and men. Now, for a long time, I've always had a question about the Sphinx. And everybody keeps, you know, making a guess or throwing out there that the Sphinx is a man. The Sphinx is a woman, has always been a woman, and that's why her face was destroyed, to try to hide that. Now, when we think of Hathor, we also need to understand that Hathor is another animal that's linked to Hathor was always the cow, the holy cow, the sacred cow. And, of course, when you think of a cow, you think of milk and, they, you know, the Milky Way. And also when you look back to nursery rhymes, the cow that jumped over the moon, they were talking about the mother goddess Hetheru Hathor. They were talking about the great creatress that birthed everything, in other words. So that's going to take me to the Milky Way and midwifery. Let's see here. All right. Milky Way midwifery. Which one do I want to touch on first? I'll touch on midwifery first, and then we'll, you know what, no, we're going to go to Milky Way first, since I just was speaking about that. I agree, Sunnubian. Sphinx or the Harmar cat is clearly and distinctly feminine. I have never seen it any other way. It's just interesting that people, a lot of people really won't come out and say that. You can tell by the structure of her face that she's feminine. All right, Milky Way. The Milky Way is our galaxy from the Greek gala, mother's milk. I'm going to stop for a minute because I realize that a lot of information is based off of Greek words and some Greek mythology. I need to interject this here, and I did this before on the first show, but I'll do it again. If anybody does any real true research on Greek mythology, they will find out that the original Greeks, called the Etruscans or Etruscans, were black people. This is before European or Caucasian people came into the Greek area, or the Crete or that Grecian area. If you look on a map, if you look on a map, Greece is very close to Africa, very close. And we also have to acknowledge that there was a point in time, and we all know this as black people, that there was a point in time when it was just us here. So do you think we were just, just hanging together out on one continent? We were a global people. So we have to stop being so narrow-minded to think that all of our history is on one continent. That is the biggest crap of bullshit I've ever heard. It's just not true. And it's portrayed that way so that people won't go all over to look for our history. It's everywhere. You have to read everything and have open mind about everything in order to really, truly research things. Thank you, Jade, for posting that Wikipedia link for Hey Diddle Diddle. All right. The Milky Way is our galaxy, from the Greek gala, meaning mother's milk. The ancients believed this heavenly star stream issued from the breast of the Queen of Heaven, which was Hathor. Worshippers Argab Hera said the stars were made of milk from Hera's moon cow incarnations. Ionians said the stars came from the udder of their own moon cow, Io, the moon. Others said the moon cow was Europa, consort of Zeus, as a totemic white bull. All white moon cows were the same goddess known from India to Scandinavia, as the nourisher of the world and the mother of the star spirits. And they're referring to cow. The four rivers of paradise were supposed to pour from the four teats of the moon cow's udders. Norsemen said these rivers came from the udder of Ardumla, the nourisher, a divine cow who existed before any other creature. She was identified with Mana, the moon mother. Scandinavian mythology knew the Milky Way as Manegvir, moon way. The Celts, it was Bathar Bothine, track of the white cow. The primordial white cow whose udders produced the star rivers was almost certainly the same cow who jumped over the moon in the nursery rhyme, because she was shown hovering over the moon in pre-Christian icons. Akkadians called the Milky Way rivers of the Divine Lady, or Higdagal, the Great River, which the Bible rendered Hiddekel in Genesis 2:14. Arabians called the Milky Way Al-Sama, Mother of the Sky. Egyptians called the Milky Way Nile in the Sky, which poured from the udders of the moon cow Hathor Isis, who thus gave rain to the rest of the world, though she reserved her true now for Egypt. Let me get a squig of water. Classic mythology made the galactic mother Galati, which meant milk goddess, a statue of Aphrodite carved by her priest consort Pygmalion, whose name was a Greek form of Phimethean, priest consort of Astarte, Hathor, and Byblos. Alternatively, the galaxy spurted from the breast of Hera when she suckled Heracles, or else it came from the breast of Rhea, who suckled Zeus. Names differed, but everywhere the Milky Way was regarded as the goddess's star milk, which formed curds to create worlds and creatures. The Rabelaisian statement that the moon is made up of green cheese dates back to old legends of the moon's creation as a ball of cheese curdled from the Milky Way. Sometimes it was the earth that was made of green cheese from the goddess milk. The Bible copied a former address to the goddess, "Hast thou not poured me out as milk and has curdled me like cheese?" And that is Job 10:10. Anglo-Saxon names for the Milky Way suggested that it was not only a river but a main street of heaven. It was called Ermine's Way, Wetlinga Street, Watling Street, Wetland Street. So they're giving different names for different cultures referring to the Milky Way. Now, the thing I find interesting about what I just read is when they speak about the moon and the moon being spit out from the Milky Way, which essentially means that the moon is not of the earth, as some people teach. And that's all I'm going to say on that one. Okay, let's go to midwifery and see what is there. Midwifery. Let me check the switchboard before I jump to the next word, just in case anyone has a question. Let's see here. Our call-in number is 646-716-7675. And please bear with me because I'm trying to keep an eye on the chat room as well. Thank you for reading along with me, Tresta, at P71. That's my girl right there. She handling business. Reading along with me. You want to call in and help me read? Oh, okay. Actually, you're probably already on the line. Is that you, 340? Okay, let me check your line, sis. Tresta, is that you, 340?
It is I.
Peace, peace. You want to help me read?
I was reading along with you, just some of those words. I was like, ooh.
I know, right? Some of these words are crazy.
Yeah.
They are crazy.
But I mean, I'll help. The best I can, if you want. Woo.
Yes, Anubian, I could use some help. All right. I ain't want to throw you out there. If you don't want to help me read, just let me know. But if you wouldn't mind helping me read, that'd be nice since, you know, you have the book there in front of you.
Yeah, see, and I just got the book today, too.
Ooh, you just got the book.
Yeah, it just came in along with the Chrome.
Okay. You want to help me read then?
Yeah. You want me to do midwifery?
Yeah. It's on page 654 in the one I have.
Okay, I got it right here. Midwifery, from Anglo-Saxon midwife, wise woman or witch. Even in the Christian era, priestesses of the Great Mother maintained their monopoly of obstetrics. For most men were afraid of the taboo mysteries of birth. The Bible declared the two mothers sacred, is that it? Or untouchable for as long as 66 days after giving birth. Leviticus 12:5, and by canon law, a mother was not allowed to enter a church until 40 days after childbed. For the first half of the Christian era, the arts of medicine remained almost exclusively in the hands of wise women because ancient healing shrines had been devoted almost exclusively to the goddess priestesses.
I want you to stop and read that whole thing again.
Starting from the first paragraph?
For the first half of the Christian era.
Okay. Even from Anglo-Saxon midwife, wise woman, or witch, even in the Christian era, priestesses of the Great Mother maintained a monopoly of obstetrics. For most men were afraid of the taboo mysteries of birth. The Bible declared the new mother sacred or untouchable for as long as 66 days after giving birth. And by canon law, a mother was not allowed to enter a church until 40 days after childbed.
Okay, I was just talking about the part where they were talking about wise women and healing shrines.
I see it. Oh, for the first half of the Christian era, the arts of medicine remained almost exclusively in the hands of wise women, because ancient healing shrines had been devoted almost exclusively to the goddess's priestesses. Keep going. In ancient Egypt, midwifery was the province of sevenfold Hathor, who gave each infant its seven... Sevenfold
Hathor. Souls.
Yeah, thank you. Hathor, who gave each infant its seven souls. The Malayan Semi still say all midwives are holy, partaking of the spirit of the first midwife who lives in the highest of the seven heavens, each one which is ruled by one of the seven celestial midwives, identical with the Hathors. An earthly midwife is a sort of fairy godmother. with a spiritual tie to each child that she brings into the world. Mexican peasants attribute similar powers to the, recibidora, who combines the functions of obstetrician, godmother, priestess, and witch. She performs complicated knot magic in binding and tying the umbilical cord and casts spells for the future fate of the newborn. Pagan Rome recognized several kinds of midwives who received separate offerings after successful birth. There was an obstetric who performed the delivery, the nutrix or nurturer who encouraged the mother's milk and taught techniques of nursing, and Terraria priestess of charged with birth rituals. All were connected with the woman's temple, like the Greek Horae, who were temple women on earth and ascended to heaven as midwives to God. Medieval Christianity detested midwives for the connection with pagan matriarchy and goddess worship.
Medieval Christianity detested midwives for their connection with pagan matriarchy and goddess worship. You know, we're going to finish reading the rest of this, but that statement alone, this is why people really don't want black women going back to midwifery and having their babies in their own birthing centers. This is why they send women to hospitals that may be in perfect health to have births. They take the control of what that woman may want and what may be more most comfortable to her, you know, and put her in a hospital. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, every woman should have their baby at home. I think that's a personal choice. But the fact of the matter is, it's almost illegal, and it's illegal in a lot of states to even practice midwifery. That fact right there is ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have four, and when I look back on it, I mean, I wish that, you know, I would have did it my way, you know, because, you know, just sitting on that table and then, you know, you're trying to push a baby out. You got gravity hitting you on the stomach.
Right,
and
against gravity.
Yeah, you're going against gravity. And, you know, at least with my first child, now with my first son, I did have the forthright. I didn't care how weird I seemed. I told the nurses and doctors, I want my placenta and I want my umbilical cord. And I'm taking it, giving it to my husband, and he's taking it home. And they did it. They looked, and they asked, well, why? I said, you got to say, it's my religion. And then they'll back off.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of women are scared to step out there and say that, you know, because they think they can be looked at funny or they can be questioned. That's you. That's your body, and that's how your baby was nourished while you carried that child in the womb. And, you know, they're using these placentas for a whole lot of things.
Yeah, and I can imagine, you know, what they're doing with, you know, a lot of mothers and unwittingly, you know, they just don't realize what they're, you know, when they go in these hospitals, what they're giving away freely.
Right. All right, let's continue. Where were we? Churchmen?
Churchmen viewed them as implacable.
Implacable
enemies of the Catholic faith. Handbooks of the Inquisition stated, no one does more harm to the Catholic faith than midwives because they invariably offer newborn children to the service of the devil with a magical baptism by the kitchen fire. The real reason for ecclesiastical hostility seems to have been the notion that midwives could help women control their own fate, learn secrets of sex and birth control, or procure abortion. The pagan women of antiquity had considerable knowledge of such matters, which were considered women's own business, not subject to male authority. Patriarchal religion, however, forbade midwives to assist with their patients in preventing conception, relieving themselves of unwanted pregnancies, or easing their child, their birth pain. In 1591, a Scottish noblewoman, Euphane McCallan, was burned alive for asking a witch midwife for drugs to ease her labor pain. Parliamentary Articles of Inquiry in 1559 ordered church wardens to report any use of charms, sorcery, enchantments, invocations, circles, witchcraft, soothsaying, or any like procedures, especially in a time of women's travail. Some, keep going?
Yeah,
I know, I'm, oh, God.
I can read it.
No, I'm reading it, it's speaking in, it's like amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's why when you look through books like this, you got to share this information, you know, because everybody doesn't have access to these books. So that's the main reason why I'm doing these shows, to explain to people how important it is to have these resources. You know,
well, I got them all from your show. It's a list of books and order them. Some charms and sorceries were allowed as long as they were of the Christian variety. That is, the Christian names substituted for pagan ones in the formulae. Women in childbed were officially advised to bind around their thighs a long charm in Latin beginning in Nomine Patris El Fili, a Spiritus Sancti Amen, followed by invocations of saints and secret names of God. If the names were not Christian, however, the charm was devilish. An Episcopal injunction of 1554 said midwives must not use or exercise any witchcraft, charms, sorcery, invocations, or prayers other than such as being allowable, and they stand with the laws and ordinances of the Catholic Church. Christianity's official view was that to relieve women's suffering in any aspect of reproduction was to uphold God's will in the matter of a curse on Eve. God decreed. That's what I'm saying now. I don't care. I had my Demerol.
See, people need to have a real understanding. See, this is what I'm saying. People need to know what symbols and myth is. First of all, Adam and Eve is not the beginning.
Exactly.
That's like the ninth inning of a ball game. That's not nearly the beginning. So when they started the Bible off wrong in the beginning,
Well, they don't realize there's many cycles of Adam and Eve. And
exactly.
Like you said, that was on the ninth inning when this set came around.
And I spoke about Adam and Eve on the last show. So, again, I keep referring to the first show, What Does It Really Mean, Part 1. That particular show, which was on April 22nd, we spoke about what Adam is and what Eve was. Now, if we have time, we're going to get into the garden and paradise, and we're going to touch on sex and hex soon as we finish with midwifery. So let's continue so we can get into the other.
Okay.
The other words.
God decreed that she and all her female descendants must bring forth children with sorrow, pain. Consequently, up to the beginning of the 20th century, doctors refused to consider treatment of the major cause of women's death, childbed, fever. The clergy held such deaths to be either a just reward for immortal life or the expression of God's continuing judgment on the sick. When James Simpson proposed to relieve women's labor pains with the newly discovered anesthetic, chloroform and ether, there was a great outcry from the clergy, who called it a sinful denial of God's wishes. According to Scottish clergymen, to relieve labor pains would be vitiating the primal curse against women. A New England minister wrote, "Chloroform is a decoy of Satan, apparently offering itself to bless women, but in the end it will harden society and rob God of the deep earnest cries which arise in a time of trouble for help." With the With the usual half-concealed sadism of patriarchal morality, he was really saying that female screams of pain gave God pleasure. And men must see to it that God was not deprived of this. The matter was resolved when Queen Victoria allowed her doctor to give her chloroform during delivery of her eighth child and publicly hailed up the new pain reliever as a great blessing. Amen. All at once, the clergyman was silent, in effect conceding to the queen the right to overrule God. Toward the end of the 19th century, male doctors moved in on the last remaining area of exclusively female medicine and took the midwifery trade away from women. At the instigation of the American Medical Association, the U.S. Congress outlawed midwives, and the new male obstetricians replaced them. Frequently, an elder midwife found herself out of work or even in jail for illegal practice in a community most of whose members she had brought into the world. The effects of the new male professionalism were not always beneficial. Our mechanized civilization and interest of speedy delivery at the convenience, even at the time participation of the physician, often endangered mother and child with impatient interference in the natural process, and too often compounded this mistake by anesthetizing the mother completely. All too soon, as a result of scientific pride over inventing a formula for feeding independent of the natural source of milk, the child was parted from his mother and deprived not only of mother's milk, but of the experience of warm, loving, commensal relationship with her, the kind we must have also with Mother Earth. The male-dominated medical profession not only took up delivering women's babies, but even presumed to teach women how to mother them, which often led to terrible mistakes like the turn of the century minimal handling theory, which assumed that crying children must not be spoiled, but cuddling them, but should be picked up only at a predetermined infrequent interval. Perhaps the ultimate hubris was attained by L.K. Frank, who wrote, "The psychiatrist is uniquely competent to tell us how to practice the Christian injunction to love children. Here is modern education ignorant of historical truth that the very existence of the human race depended for countless thousands of years, long before either Christianity or psychiatry were heard of, on a unique ability of mothers to love little children and of wise women to assist the instincts of motherhood."
This is very, very, very interesting. I'm trying to pull my switchboard back up. I don't know what block.
I'm trying not to pull my locks out.
What'd you say?
I said, I'm trying not to pull my locks out.
Well, what you reading?
I'm really happy that, you know, you're pointing these different, sections out, on these words, because, like even what Pastor Flower said, just knowing, what these words mean and, where they come from and the origin and how we got where we are now, and hopefully we'll be off into greater pastures and learn from our quote-unquote mistakes.
All right, I'm going to go to another word. We're going to go to hex. And I stumbled across this word when I was looking through some of the words that were already on my list here. I stumbled across this one and thought it was rather interesting to share tonight. We have all heard of a hex before, like a hex woman or somebody put a hex on you and, stuff like that. So, like to hear it? Here you go. I used to like In Living Color, but anyway. Hex. This word for a witch's spell had a long history associated with the connotations of the number six. Greek hex, Latin sex, cognate with Egyptian sexin, to embrace or to copulate. Six was everywhere the number of sex, representing the union between the triple goddess and her trident-bearing consort, which is why Christian authorities call six the number of sin. Pythagoras, on the contrary, called six the perfect number, or the mother, one of its Egyptian forms, Seshemu, which meant sexual intercourse. Shown in hieroglyphics by male and female genitals in conjunction, survived in the Sufi love charm designed to open the cave of the goddess, open sesame. To this day, hex signs are hexagonal, like the six-pointed tantric yantra of love. See the hexagram. The name of the sign is from German hexen, which means witches, who may have been so named because they made the six. And I got into what witches and witchcraft meant on the last show as well. I mean, anybody who has missed these, you know, shows where we're getting into these words, please, please, please go back and listen, because it has very vital information. Very vital information. Can you finish off hex briefly while I try to pull Blog Talk back up, because I had to log out and log back in? I would really appreciate that.
You stopped it to this day?
No. I stopped at the next paragraph is where you can start a triple six.
Okay. A triple six. 666 was the magic number of triple Aphrodite, or Ishtar, in the guise of the fate. The Book of Revelations called it the number of the beast, Revelation 13:18. Apparently the beast with two backs, the androgyn of carnal love, Solomon the wizard king, made a sacred marriage with the goddess and acquired a mystic 666 talents of gold, 1 Kings 10:14. Christians usually call it Satan's number, yet the reoccurrence of this number in esoteric traditions are often surprising. For example, the maze of Chartres Cathedral was planned so as to be exactly 666 feet long. Egyptians considered 3, 6, and 7 the most sacred numbers. 3 stood for a triple goddess. 6 meant her union with God. 7 meant the 7 Hathors, 7 planetary spheres, 7 gated holy cities, 7-year reigns of God, etc. Egyptians had an abiding conviction that the total number of all deities must be exactly 37. Because of this number's magic properties, not only did it combine a sacred 3 and 7, but 37 multiplied by the multiple of 3 gave triple digit or trinity. 1-1-1, 2-2-2, 3-3-3, 4-4-4, 5-5-5, etc. The miraculous number 666 is a product of 3 times 6 times 37 squared.
Very, very, very interesting. Yeah, let's get into, let me see, how much time do we have remaining? We have about 24 minutes remaining in live stream. I already know that we are going to go over. So we're just going to keep it going. I want to get into, again, when we went over hex, we ran back into what word we had already gone over? Androgen.
Yeah, androgen.
You know, so research, read, go within, you know, get this information. It's out here. Now, I did say we were going to touch on bisexual. I want to see what that word means. Now, I have not pulled this word up in this book, so I don't even know if it has it. I'm just going to check. I do not believe that this word means what people use it as today. But let's see if it's here. No, I don't think that is in this, in here. Let me check one other place. Yeah, I don't think, yeah, it's not in here. But I'll go ahead and give you what I know, or what I have come across in my research. Currently, when everyone hears the word bisexual, they're thinking it's a person that likes both sexes. According to my research, bisexual means a person who has both sexual organs, a entity, a being that has both sexual organs, not a person that copulates or has sex with male and female. So, again, it goes back to that androgen, the word bisexual is not relating to the act of sex, it's just talking about the genitalia, having both, which is what bi means, it means two. So I just want to throw that out there. I'm going to touch on man and see what this book has to say about man. All right. Man. The original Old Norse man meant woman. The word for man was not man but were, from the Sanskrit root vir, as in werewolf, the man wolf. The name man meant the moon, creatress of all creatures, according to Scandinavian and other tribes throughout Europe. Even in Imperial Rome, man or mana was the mother of all manes or ancestral spirits. The Sanskrit root man meant moon and wisdom, both the primary attributes of the great goddess. Heathen scholars composed a class of sacred love songs to the feminine principle of the moon and her earthly incarnations, woman. Those were man song or woman song. They were expressly prohibited by the Catholic Church. The Isle of Man was formerly sacred to the moon goddess, who was sometimes a mermaid or an androgynous Aphrodite who kept men's souls in pots turned upside down, i.e. grave mounds and beehive tombs. Passage graves in East Jutland were full of upturned pots, an Iron Age burial custom. The same custom was mentioned in South America, where the moon carries souls away and places them in upturned pots. Apparently, the Isle of Man used to be a sacred Isle of the Dead. The name of its deity was variously rendered man, mana, mana anna, or maninin. The island used to have an enchanted place with a crypt or a chapel of 13 pillars, the sacred number of the old lunar year. Every visitor was expected to count the pillars. If the counting ceremony was omitted, the visitor would be imprisoned in the crypt, which indicates a burial place sacred to the moon. The site was later destroyed by salt spilled on the ground, a reference to Christians' habit of leaving pagan shrines and sowing the ground with salt to make it infertile. The moon goddess appeared in Max's legend as a fairy queen who sometimes led the whole male population into the sea, where they perished. Most probably, they perished first and were given to the sea womb, as in the ancient Norse funeral rite. The fairy queen escaped annihilation by the priest when she took the form of a wren, which is W-R-E-N. But pious Maxmen organized wren hunts, a custom followed every New Year day, thereafter killing scores of the little birds in an effort to kill Jenny Wren, the fairy. The feathers of the slain wren were said to preserve sailors from shipwrecks, and no Manx sailor would go to sea without one. The wren hunts possibly were pre-Christian, with the legend of the fairy queen invented for a new rationale. Before the missionaries came, wrens probably were the sole birds sacrificed to the goddess. Balancy said the Druids considered the wren supreme among all birds. The superstitious respect shown to the bird gave offense to our first Christian missionaries, and by their commands, he is still hunted and killed by the peasants on Christmas Day and on the following St. Stephen's Day. He is carried about, hung by leg in the center of two hoops crossing each other at right triangles. Wow. All right. It's something else I wanted to touch on. It's a lot of words I have here, but one of them I wanted to touch on last time that I didn't get a chance to was the swastika. So I'm going to go there. The swastika. A lot of people may not know that the swastika became popularized, so-called, by the Nazis using the swastika. But what they don't know is that the swastika is one of our ancient sacred symbols. Some people use it turned to the left, and some people use it turned to the right, and they mean different things. But I will just give you some basic information that is here, and if it's of interest to you, you can go study it for yourself. Okay. Swastika. Those who know the swastika only as Nazi Heckenkreuz, Hook Cross, may be surprised to learn that this is one of the oldest, most widely distributed religious symbols in the world. Swastikas appear on Paleolithic carvings on mammoth ivory from the Ukraine dated circa 10,000 BC. Swastikas figure on the oldest coinage in India, Persia, Asia Minor, and Greece, represented the rotating axis mundi with the symbol of a swastika. On a Boeotian amphora of the 7th century BC, the swastika was presented as a sacred sign to the goddess Artemis. It also represented many other deities from Iceland to Japan, Scandinavia to North Africa. It was much used in Troy and Mycenae before the 13th century BC. Sanskrit swastika meant so be it or amen. In Japan, the swastika was an ideogram for infinity, the number 10,000, which was a synonym for infinity because it was the highest number Japanese sages could visualize. I'm going to pause there. The swastika is also full circle 360 degrees, 490 degree angles. You are correct, Sun Nubian, and it is an ancient African symbol. The funny thing that I'm realizing here with what I'm reading is the number 10,000. And we all know this, the goddess of 10,000 names. So that 10,000 is very synonymous with the goddess because she's said to have 10,000 or more names, which is true. There were two basic types of swastikas, the left pointing counterclockwise, Wider Shin's versions called the moon swastika, and the right pointing clockwise one called the sun swastika. The former was naturally associated with the left hand path of the goddess. The latter was the right hand path of the god. See left hand. And see left hand, a lot of people talk about this left hand path, but no one really knows what the left hand really means and what that left hand symbolized. But it definitely has something to do with the goddess. I'll see if I have time later to get in the left hand, or we can save that for another show, because there will be definitely more follow-up shows, because this book here has some very interesting information. And when you hear certain people, when you hear people clarify words that have been used before, it just opens up your mind and gets those wheels turning for you to go research and put two and two together to come up with what shit really means. All right, let's see here. Hindus said the solar swastika represented the god Ganesha, Lord of Hosts, and the lunar swastika stood for Kali Maya, his virgin bride, the mother of Buddha. As a reincarnation of his divine father, Buddha displayed the sign of a cross with a swastika enclosed in the female circle at the end of each arm. Tibetan Buddhists said the right-handed swastika was the savior. The left-handed swastika meant witchcraft or the magic of Mother Maya. The feminine moon swastika received the name of suvastika and was said to represent the autumnal half of the year where the sun wanes, while the masculine swastika stood for the vernal season when the sun grows stronger. As the feminine suvastika suggested the sun god declining toward his death and resurrecting at the winter solstice, it sometimes signified rebirth. In Japan, the reborn Amida, Buddha of immeasurable light, wore a left-handed swastika carved on his breast. A similar-handed swastika was a sign of Thor, hammer on Scandinavian coins. Thor was one of the gods supposed to have come from ancient Troy, and Trojan images of the great goddess showed a swastika with a female triangle on her belly, indicating the hidden god prior to his next rebirth. Early Christians adopted the swastika to represent Christ, calling it a crux dissimulata, or disguised cross. It was also called crux gammata, gammadion, or gamma cross, because it showed the Greek letter gamma four times repeated. To Saxons, it was philfot, translated either 4 foot, referring to the four heavenly pillars at the corners of earth, or philfoot, referring to the Christian habit of filling in the foot of a church window with swastikas. That's interesting. In old Danish churches, the swastika was an unusual ornamentation for the baptismal font. It was also much used in medieval heraldry as a cross-potent rebated cross gamme or cross crampone. Steel knights who wore the swastika on their shields couldn't be sure whether it stood for the cross of Christ or the cross of Thor, the latter being revered in swastika form all over the Germanic areas, including Scandinavian settlements in Lincolnshire and Yorkshire. Okay, that's all I'm going to read on the swastika. So everybody should have some basic peace, God bless. She pops. I just seen your PM in the chat room. Yeah, left-hand path is more evil than the right-hand path. It's all you. All of it is us. As Pastor Flower says, you are the devil and the god, goddess. So it's all us. It's all us. All right, I want to get into the garden, because earlier when we were reading about some things, we ran across the word garden. So let's see if we can figure out what garden really means. That will shed some light on some things. Let me check the switchboard. All right, we have about 10 minutes remaining. And, again, if anyone has any questions or comments, feel free to call in 646-716-7675 and press 1 on the switchboard so I will know, I mean, on your keypad, so I will know that you have a question. All right. Garden. I'm going to be upset if they do not have garden in here. Says, look through your book and see if you can find garden. For some reason, I'm not coming across it. Maybe they don't have it in here.
They don't have it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll go to paradise because the garden was considered paradise, so I'm sure they have one of these. N-O-P. Paradise. Oh, they do have paradise. Okay. I see your comment, Miss India. I don't think I want to be the devil. We have to understand that the ancients knew what polarity was and that you couldn't have good or positive without something that other people ended up referring to as negative or the devil. It's just polarity. It's just a law of opposites. Remember when we were little and we watched cartoons and the child or the character in a cartoon would have they would be thinking something, and then these two angels would pop up on the shoulder. One would be white and have wings, and that was said to be the angel. Then the other one would be red and look all fiery, and that was said to be the devil. Those two entities are within each of us. You can be the kindest person that anyone could meet, but the minute somebody piss you off or say something about your mama or talk shit about your children or do some shit to your kids, the devil gonna come right up out your ass quickly. Quickly. It's the same thing. So, you know, when we're looking at, you know, the dark side versus the light, or evil versus good, or negative versus positive, they're just polarities. Just polarities. All right, paradise. Woo. I don't know if I'm going to want to read all this. All right, let's see. I'm going to try to read the first two paragraphs. Hopefully we can get a good idea of what paradise really is. We should probably already know where paradise is. I'm sure the men know where paradise is. It's the same place as heaven. All right, I'm having too much fun with this. The Persian paradise was a magic garden surrounding the holy mountain of the gods, where the tree of life bore the fruit of immortality. Paradisia was also the divine virgin who would give birth to the future redeemer, the Mahdi, or Messiah, or Savior, or desired knight of Saracenic Grail myths. Shiite Arabs still look for the coming of the Virgin Paradise, the next Holy Mother. Hebrew Pardes, or garden, was derived from the same Virgin Paradise. In Solomon's Song, the enclosed garden is the Virgin Bride whose fountain of life-giving fluid is not yet opened. And that's the Song of Solomon 4:12. A dual vision of paradise as a living garden and the living garden as a female body runs through all religious symbolism. Lorenzo the Magnificent stated that the same ancient theme in his description of heaven. Nothing other than a pleasant garden, abundant with all pleasing and delightful things of trees, apples, flowers, vivid running waters, a song of birds, and in effect all amenities dreamed of by the heart of man. And by this one can affirm that paradise was where there was a beautiful woman. For here was a copy of every amenity and sweetness that a kind heart might desire. The physiological model of paradise was life's first experience of comforting love, the mother, who warmed and fed the infant right after its terrifying birth trauma. Having fallen from the comfort of the womb into a world of painful stimuli, if the child is not embraced and lulled into the illusion that the lost paradise has nearly been regained, the foundations for later neurosis will be laid. Often the dweller in paradise was in a state of pseudo-infancy, when an Egyptian pharaoh came to his two divine mothers in the afterworld, they drew their breasts into his mouth and never more do they wean him. Egyptian funerary priestesses bared their breasts when escorting a dead man to his tomb, probably a magical promise of the nursing goddess's tender care. As further insurance, she was painted inside the sarcophagus lid, reaching down with her arms to clasp the deceased against her bared breast like a mother reaching for her baby. I'm going to pause there because when we look at Goddess of 10,000 Names, it really is true. It's really only one, which is the creatress, which is a goddess, a womb that created everything. So when we look at Hathor and when we look at Hathor and Nut really is the same thing. They're just different depictions and different expressions of the same goddess, the same mother, the same creatress, the same god. Okay, so when we look at the inside of a lot of the pharaoh's sarcophagus, all you saw was Nut painted and carved inside of these sarcophagus. So that is exactly what I just read in essence. When the ancients were buried, they were going back to heaven. They knew exactly where they were going. And that heaven was always resembled by a woman because she was heaven. Primitive notions of paradise as land flowing with milk and honey was clearly representative of the body in the earliest memories. An elderly Kikuyu chief of these memories still vivid in his mind. Trusty, can you read that portion on page 769 for me, please?
Sure.
Thank
she
you.
Was always there. I can remember the comforting feel of her body as she carried me on her back and the smell of her skin in the hot sun.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me interject right quick. We have 2 minutes remaining in the live stream. I want to say thank you to everyone that came out tonight to listen and participate with the show. If you would like to hear the remainder of the show, please call in. Our call-in number is 646-716-7675. All right, continue, sis.
Okay, I can remember the comforting feel of her body as she carried me on her back and the smell of her skin in the hot sun. Everything came from her. When I was hungry or thirsty, she would swing me around to where I could reach her full breast. Now when I shut my eyes, I feel again with gratitude the sense of well-being that I had when I buried my head in their softness and drank the sweet milk they gave. At night, when there was no sun to warm me, her arms, her body took its place. And as I grew older and more interested in other things, from my safe place on her back, I could watch without fear as I wanted. And when sleep overcame me, I had only to close my eyes.
Western culture made this paradise, the birthright of every primitive child, a paradise lost. Dr. Henry pointed out that no other culture has invented so many excuses for keeping a mother away from her infant. Wickler said a human baby is like a monkey baby. By nature, a mother hugger and should be carried against the mother's body continuously in the early days of his life, as is still the custom among primitive races today. The entire behavior of repertory of the newborn baby is adapted for this. It is not biological for us to place our babies in cribs. Symptomatic of this is that the babies cry out of loneliness with abnormal frequency in our culture, while one scarcely ever finds this among children of primitive people. And when people say primitive, when you're talking about history or anthropology, when they say primitive, they mean original people, aboriginal or original people. They're talking about us. Psychologists know the image of the lost mother is projected into the sexual partner, which accounts for the extraordinary sexual significance attached to the woman's breast. Erasmus Darwin noted that the symbolism even goes beyond the breast per se. When any object of vision is presented to us by which its waving or spiral lines bear any similitude to form of the female bosom, we experience an attraction to embrace it with our arms and to salute it with our lips as we did in our early infancy, the bosom of our mother. Man often sees himself in an infantile relationship to a woman who may be embraced and kissed, that is, a wife or mistress. The Bengali poet Chandidas addressed himself to a loved woman as if he were her infant. I have taken refuge at your feet, my beloved. You are to me as a parent to a helpless child. A psychiatrist notes the most sexual fantasies of adult males seem to appropriate for a naive four-year-old whose most important gratification primarily depend on mother. He shows unacknowledged signs of longing for her with the same fervor he did when she was all the world to him. The holy center of his child's universe, his desires seem unmodified by his conscious perception and understanding of the realities of life and the limited possibilities for gratification with his mother. Okay, that's all I'm going to read right there in terms of paradise. I think that gives everyone a synopsis of who and what and where paradise is. All right. I want to go into, okay, I did Paradise. We did Hex, and we know what a hexagram is. I'm going to pull up Fatima and Karuna and Queen and Goddess, because I think we use Queen and Goddess a lot, and some people don't like using the word Queen because they think it means one thing, and some people don't like using the word Goddess because they think it means one thing. So let's see if we can get some clarification on that. So I'm going to look up Fatima first, though. And I think I looked up Corey, but I think I did that last week, but I might touch on that before we get off the line tonight. I'm going to open the lines in a moment, just in case some of the sisters have comments or questions. Telling y'all, if you do not have this book, it is a good read, and it's a good thing to have at home. You know, when you run across things in your studies, you can refer to this book. It's a great reference book. Okay, Fatima or Fatima. The Arabian moon goddess in a Muhammadanized incarnation as Muhammad's fictitious daughter, who was nevertheless described as mother of her father. Her name means the creatress. She was also known as the source of the sun, tree of paradise, the moon, and fate. She existed from the beginning of the material world. In brief, she was really none other than the great goddess. Like the Virgin Mary, her Western counterpart, Fatima was officially demoted to mortality, but still kept most of her old titles and powers. And it refers to the word Arabia. And now I know I did go over the word Arabia for certain in the last, in part one. So, let's see. Let's go to Corey. All right, let me open up some of the lines briefly, just in case the sisters have any comments or questions. We have a caller, 678. Could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from? 678. All right. We have caller from area code 614. Could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from? I guess no one wants to speak with us tonight, Tresta. Sister Earth, are you still on the line?
Yes.
Okay. All right, area code 901. Could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from?
Yes, my name is Memphis Tichette, and I'm just listening. I'm new at it. New, very, very new. So
okay.
I'm learning.
Okay, okay. Well, I hope, you know, this show in particular and the archives will help you, you know, on your path. And, like I said, just let me know if you have a question or anything. I'm going to check one other line. Area code 616, could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from?
Hi, Sheik. This is Lisa, and I'm calling from Michigan.
Okay, Pieces. How are you?
Good. Lisa.
Right. I heard you.
Oh,
all
okay.
Right. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
I'm good. All right. Oh, I just wanted to check the lines just to make sure no one had a question or anything, because sometimes, you know, people are shy, so I have to call them out. All right. Well, I'm going to put you back on mute. If you have a question or comment, make sure you press 1 on the switchboard. Okay. Corey. Let's see. Oh, we went over Quran. Last time I thought we went over Quran and Corey. As a matter of fact, we did. So let me skip to Queen, because I know we went over Quran and Corey last time. So we'll go ahead and go to Queen and Goddess. and see what we can find. Tresta.
Yep, right here.
Okay. The first show, part one, did this show help, you know, going through these words and going through this book, does this help you in terms of studying?
Oh, it does, definitely. I mean, and especially the last show you did, the My Son series you did.
Oh, the Masonic Secrets of the Goddess Unveiled.
Yeah, I mean, what that helped, that show and the one, what does it mean, part one, that helped me because, but on the My Son podcast, you both gave out a list of the books. And I immediately sat down, you know, went back into the archives, immediately sat down with pen and paper and wrote down a list of the books. And in addition to other books that, you know, on the other previous show, The Order of My Eye, and cross-referenced and, you know, and just found a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of, you know, like, now you understand when they mean that this world is illusionary. Because once you go back onto these different words and Pastor Flowers always say it, you know, throughout all the series, go back and find out what these words truly mean. And then when you do that, you find out, oh, now it really hits home that this world is truly illusionary. It's a big illusion.
It's illusionary, but the funny part is they'll tell you, well, yeah, you know, we black people or we, you know, whatever they want to call it, black African Moors, whatever the favorite is for the day. You know, we're original people, you know, we got melanin, we can do all this. But then in the next breath, we start talking about what we can't do because somebody holding us back, this and the third. Well, if we're melanated people, then we have to control our thoughts. Because our brain is what brings everything into reality, you know, but that's another topic for another time. That's the reality. What's inside, what you're thinking, what you produce with your thoughts is really what the reality is. But like I said, we'll touch on that a different time. I'm going to go ahead and go into Queen, Old Norse Kvaen, spelled K-V-A-E-N. Old English queen, spelled C-W-E-N-E, meant owner, specifically applied to female owners of the land in the days of the matriarchy. Ancient writers describe many barbarian societies as nations of queens. See matrilineal inheritance, and we'll touch on that in a different show. Now I'm going to go to goddess. And then to end the show out, we will talk about, let's talk about sex. We're going to go into sex, prostitute, Karuna, and Kadesha. Those are things that a lot of people don't want to touch when it comes to sex and really knowing and owning that, because that's what they try to lock women down with, is our sexuality and our sexual energy. But that energy is being used to run every damn thing, except a lot of us have given our power away to other people. So as one of the sisters said in the chat room on the show, Masonic Secrets of the Goddess Unveiled, she was like, it's time to snatch the cat back. I told her we were going to have to use that comment. It's time to snatch the cat back. That's serious. Okay. All right. Goddess. Let's see what that word has. Few words are so revealing of the Western sexual prejudice as the word goddess. In contrast to the word God, modern connotations vastly differ from those of the ancients, to whom the goddess was a full-fledged cosmic parent figure who created the universe and its laws, ruler of nature, fate, time, eternity, truth, wisdom, justice, love, birth, death, etc. Male writers through the centuries broke the goddess figure down into innumerable goddesses using different titles or names she received from different people at different times. if such a system had been applied to the usual concept of God, there would now be a multitude of separate gods with the names like Almighty, Yahweh, Lord, Holy Ghost, Son of Righteous, Christ, Creator, Lawgiver, Jehovah, Providence, Allah, Savior, Redeemer, Paraclete, Heavenly Father, and so on, ad infinitum. Each one assigned a particular function in the world pantheon. During the Middle Ages, most of the old names and titles of male deities were amalgamated as secret names of the one god, while the names and titles of the goddesses were ever more minutely classified, and some were even masculinized, humanized, and diabolized. Yet such classification tends to disintegrate under deeper study that reveals the same archetypal characteristic in nearly all the goddesses. I was just speaking about this. Probing ancient views of the goddess is instructive. It shows a female figure almost always more powerful than the male. Not only is she his mother, the author of his being, she is also the deity who infuses all creation with the vital blood of life. Gods prosper only when they partake of her wisdom or adopt her powers until they commit the ultimate hubris, symbolic matricide. By setting up an all-masculine theology, the strength of the goddess was harnessed to support new male religions, as the strength of women's nurturing, caretaking instinct was harnessed to a patriarchal marriage system supporting men. And we touched on what marriage and what wife and husbandry went on the last show, too. So, anyway, even today, scholars tend to call all ancient deities gods when they include both male and female, and sometimes the oracular utterances of the goddesses are said to emanate from a god. I'm going to stop there, because when you go back to ancient Kemet, for one, all of the gods worship the goddess in one form or another. So if your deities bow down to a goddess and worship that goddess as the supreme deity and the creator, there it is. Perhaps one should take more seriously the ancients' often repeated opinion that their goddesses had a thousand names. Every female divinity in the present encyclopedia may be correctly regarded as only another aspect of the core concept of a female supreme being. No modern temples perpetuate this core concept. Men long since tore down the goddesses' shrines as Christian gospels commanded them to do so, Acts 19:27. Yet even in a society that trivialized and vilified it, the core concept lives on. Some people believe that a new feminine theology will emerge from the core concept during the present century. All right. So that is it on the goddess. I'm going to go ahead and go to Qadeshet, and that is spelled Qadeshet. Arabic, Qadisha. Hebrew, Qadesha, meant a sacred harlot or holy virgin. Qadeshet was also the title of Astarte, her temple, and her temple women. The word meant priestess. In the Quran, it was used as a name for Muhammad's rich wife, Khadija, whose money supported the prophet's endeavors. Astarte, the Qadeshet, was the Syrian counterpart of Ishtar, Babylon's great whore, who declared herself the mother of compassion. Now, that's taking me into prostitute. So I'm going to go there. Goddess Networks, I've opened your line. Did you have anything to add on anything we've discussed or touched on so far?
No, sis.
All right. That's a really big write-up on prostitution, so we're going to... Hmm. y'all need to get this book so y'all can read this. Read this. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Trista, I'm going to need your help on this one.
Yeah,
or Goddess Network if you have your book near you. Because I want to go into some of this on prostitution. And you know what? Before I get to the word prostitution, let me go to the word corona. Because if I'm not mistaken, that word has something to do with harlots and Kadesha as well. So let me get there because I know that I think that's a short write up on the word corona. Okay. Karuna, tantric term for the basic quality of mother love, directly experienced in infancy and ramified in adulthood to embrace all forms of love. Touching, tenderness, compassion, sexual enjoyment, and eroticism. Many centuries before Freudian psychology recognized infantile sexuality, tantric sages called Karuna the essence of religion, a gut feeling of loving kindness, as opposed to the often cruel or useless verbalization of theological principles. It was understood that karuna must be learned through physical and sexual contact, comfort by adults and children alike. Thus, the identity of infantile, sexual, warmly loving, and religious behavior patterns was perceived long ago and is just now being rediscovered by Western civilization. The ancients well knew the experience of being in love recapitulates the mother-child relationship in its intimate physical attachment, trust, and dependence. Recognition of one particular other as a love object surely evolved from the instinctive mechanism that binds together individual mothers and offspring. It has been shown even in the animal realm that adequate sexual functioning in adulthood depends on satisfactory relations with the mother in infancy. In ancient times, the goddess sacred whores were special teachers of Karuna, which may have been the root of modern Italian Carogna, which is whore. Pagan Rome gave the great goddess the title of Matacara, mother beloved. She combined all qualities of sexuality, motherhood, marital bliss, friendship, generosity, mercy, or caritas, which was the Christian church later purged of its sensual implication and transformed it into charity, the giving of money to earn points in the afterlife. I got to pause there because the church I used to go to used to always practice caritas. I remember. Ooh, that's funny. It's just funny how a lot of this stuff is right in front of our face, and because we don't know what it really means, we have no clue how to put the pieces of this puzzle together. All right. The Greek version of Karuna was embodied in the Charites or Graces, the naked triple goddess whose quality of grace was also altered in the Christian context. In Babylon, the great mother under the same name of Ishtar was also the great whore and the lover of all men, expressing Karuna in her self-description. A prostitute compassionate I am. The Christian derivative of Mary Ishtar was Mary Magdalene, the sacred harlot who said harlots are compassionate of all race of mankind. Gnostic Gospels mention Mary Magdalene as the original female pope. Embodying the true Christian spirit kept secret from male apostles, while it passed directly from Jesus through his surpassing love for Mary. Significantly, Christian iconographers often confuse Mary the harlot and Mary the mother. See prostitution. So it's more information there on Karuna, but I'm going to go ahead and go to prostitution. All right. Prostitution. Like the devadesis of Hindu temples, prostitute priestesses dispensed the grace of the goddess in the ancient Middle Eastern temples. They were often known as charities or graces, since they dealt in the unique combination of beauty and kindness called charis, or the Latin charitas, that was later translated to charity. Actually, it was like Hindu karuna, a combination of mother love, tenderness, comfort, mystical enlightenment, and sex. Hesiod said the sensual magic, or sex magic, of the sacred whore or hooray, mellowed the behavior of men. Ishtar, the great whore of Babylon, announced, "A prostitute compassionate I am." Mary Magdalene said of her sisters in the profession, "Not only are we compassionate of ourselves, but we are compassionate of all the race of mankind." Ancient harlots often commanded high social status and were revered for their learning. As embodiments of the Queen of Heaven, in Palestine called Kadeshet, the Great Whore, the harlots were honored like queens at centers of learning in Greece and Asia Minor. Some even became queens. The Empress Theodora, wife of Justinian, began her career as a temple harlot. St. Helena, the mother of Constantine, was a harlot before she became an empress saint. In an Egyptian story, a priestess of Bubastis demanded all of the man's worldly goods for one night of her love. She said, "I am a Herodule. I am no mean person." Until recently, Egypt still had a class of women called Gazai, a sacred whore, who were greatly honored in the time of Mamluks and prized as brides when their period of service ended. Temple prostitutes were revered as healers of the sick. Their very secretions were supposed to have medicinal virtues. A Sufi proverb still suggests this opinion. There is healing in a woman's vagina. Even their spittle could perform cures. Jesus cures blindness by spittle, Mark 8:23. Was copied from a matriarchal tradition. A clay tablet from the Neve says eye diseases can be cured by a harlot's spittle. Harlots were also sorcerers, prophets, and seers. The Hebrew word zonah means both a prostitute and a prophetess. Holy Mothers designated the promiscuous priestess shamaness of Japan, also known as spirit women, becoming brides of God. They entered the shrine to lie with a priest possessed by the god spirit. Similar customs distinguish the Indian devadasis, human copies of the lavacious heavenly nymphs. The profession was popular. The temple of Aphrodite or Eryx, Corinth, Cyprus, and other sites were served by a thousand sacred harlots apiece. When Hellenic Greeks reduced wives to the status of servants, the heterae or courtesans remained legally and politically equal to men. Roman matrons of the highest aristocracy prostituted themselves in the temple of Juno. Suspita. When a revelation was needed, even Babylonian women prostituted herself in the temple before marriage. By Amorite sacred law, she who was about to be married should sit in fornication 7 days by the gate of the temple. Such laws were supposed to appease the goddess who disapproved of monogamy in the era when there were no formal marriage and children didn't know their fathers. In Greek myth, the Great Mother forbade the Heavenly Father Zeus to make a monogamous marriage, holding that only her own ancient system of group marriage was honorable. The tantric word for a sacred harlot was Vashia, probable origin of the goddess oldest name in Greece and Rome. Hestia or Vesta, the hearth mother, served by Vestal virgins who were originally harlot priestesses. Hearth and earth both arose from the altar of the Saxon goddess Eartha or Hertha. The northern Hestia Vesta in the matriarchal age, every woman's hearth fire was her altar. The hearth was also Omphalos, feminine hub of the universe, navel stone of the temple around the sacred harlots performed their dances of time. I'm going to stop there and just indicate, while I was reading that, I kept thinking about Eartha Kitt. All right, I'm about all read out for the night. So, let me see. Is anything else on this list that I could, I got to? Oh, let me see if they have harem in here, because I think harem goes right in with what I'm reading. And I hope, you know, the sisters that are on the line can use this information to now, you know, with open minds and go in and do their own research and find some things out. Y'all might be able to help me with some research. Call me up and tell me what y'all are getting.
C.
Yo.
Okay, I'll make sure I was on. Hey, this Kendra. A few months back, a sister and I had some words on my page. She's unsubscribed because of this particular topic. And when I don't know because it still baffles me, but when any time you really getting into like the meat of what the goddess or the, you know, the black woman is God is really about, you have to let go of everything that you think that you know.
Yep.
She only could see that sacred prostitution had to do with sex and that these women were sleeping with all types of men. It didn't matter that I told her these women were very, very educated. They were like the upper crust of the civilizations. They were masters of aromatherapy, wealth, charity. It didn't matter what I told her, that they were the socialites of these civilizations. She only saw that they were prostitutes and whores. And to me, the whole BET, I mean, all this glorification of the negative aspect of sex with black women is a huge attack on women's sexuality. That is why I enjoy Diva Mama Tanya.
Right.
Because she is bringing a lot of this stuff back. There are women.
Exactly.
These courtesans ain't no joke. These women rule these men. And, you know, we talk about the patriarchs all the time, but they are funded and encouraged by these sacred temple prostitutes, these, you know what these white people call them, courtesans nowadays. These women are backing these men. And my girlfriend went to NYC a few months back, and without getting all into this stuff, she was just baffled at the amount of money some men would pay women just to talk to them.
Certain clubs
now, with these high-priced courtesans, these just women that utilize their sexual energy for a lot of things, not just sex. And where these women just, and remember that one guy, that one senator, that Elliot Spitzer guy that was married but got in a lot of trouble because he was spending all that money on that courtesan. I think it was like $100,000, and he wasn't even sleeping with her. There is another side to the goddess that is just powerful and linked to sexuality, and at the same time it has nothing to do with sex. And that's really where I, you know, wish all of us end up getting, instead of selling out our power, sexuality, you know, fluids for trinkets.
See, a lot of people don't connect spirit and sex. It's one. It's not separate. You know, spirit and sex is one. And that's why when we start, the thing I've noticed going on the path I'm going with trying to research and find out true information about the goddess and about our original form and what happened to us and how we came to be the women that we are and how men came to be who and what they are. When I research that, I see that a lot of men will keep trying to portray the fact that sex is bad, and that's the biggest crock of bullshit I've ever heard. What they don't want us to know is sex is the goddamn key to everything, and that sex ain't necessarily a spiritual act. Sex isn't necessarily a physical act is what I meant to say.
Right.
It's not always a physical act. You know, it's a lot of mind play. Sometimes you can have sex with somebody just by talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why men pay for that shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the physical, you know, I'm going to put my penis in her vagina type thing, or I'm going to get on top of him and ride him till the cows come home. It is that sometimes, but I'm going to keep it real. It is that sometimes, but the biggest aspect of it, sometimes you have sex with somebody before you even physically get with them like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what foreplay is. That's the actual sex, after sex right there. It's not even, it's very spiritual. You know,
I was going to interject, and also, you know, even if everybody can do the research on the geisha. These women, you know, are very highly educated, just like
mm-hmm.
the sister.
Yep.
Very highly educated in the arts,
mm-hmm.
in the of course the tea ceremony and everything. And these rich millionaire Japanese businessmen
mm-hmm.
pay them numerous amounts of money, not for sex, but for the art of conversation
mm-hmm.
and
okay,
stimulating the mind.
At this point, I'm tired of sugarcoating. I'm gonna take the gloves off for a minute. And I'm going to speak directly to people that may not be getting it. And I'm sorry if this rubs you the wrong way. It may need to. People need to stop acting like you too fucking good to realize what the hell this shit is about. Everything comes back to the woman. Every fucking thing. I don't care if you're looking at a tree, a blade of glass, or that $100 bill in your hand. Everything comes back to the black woman and our energy. Our energy is the currency. Our sexual power, our sexual energy is being used on so many different levels. That is why they keep trying to call you a whore, and that is why they keep trying to call you promiscuous, and we don't even know what the hell this shit means.
And interesting, see, when you think about it and look at this stuff, everybody's, and you know, I was talking to this girl that is like ex-porn the other day, and she was talking about how the porn industry is a billion-dollar industry,
sure
but
is.
The women of that industry get less than 1% of that revenue.
Of course,
everybody
of course.
Is getting paid off of the sexuality of women, especially black women in our community. The men are okay with not being monogamous, but none of it is benefiting us. It's benefiting him. We have such messed up mindsets when it comes to sexuality. Them women didn't just sleep with no anybody.
No, they did not.
Anybody couldn't, just like their sister was talking about them geishas, anybody couldn't just partake with them women, and it wasn't just because of sex. They were the socialites. They were the creme de la creme. They were highly educated, masters of art and music.
I mean,
well, I just hope the sisters get it right. But, that sister got upset with me. And unsubscribe from my page, honey.
Well, I mean, the truth is not meant for everybody. And I mean, like a wise sister already told me, it's gonna be a lot of people that's not gonna like some things that I have to say. But I'm not here to amuse people. I'm here to share my searching of the truth with other sisters who are ready to know, you know, who are ready to get the information. Because for a long time, people have known this information and have hidden it.
Mm-hmm. And everybody's
I'm not here trying to be popular. I'm not here trying to create a following. I'm here because I genuinely have an interest and I want to know. And for those sisters who are on that same path, we can exchange information and go like that. That's what I'm here for. You know, I'm not here to amuse people and play games. I really want to know the truth about this shit. And as I'm finding it, I'm going to bring it to you. I don't care if it's two people in the chat room or 202. You know, that's it.
Yeah, and I think and this is why I love Diva Mama Tanya's work, because I think we just really are going to have to change a complete mindset and not think that, you know, that we can be sold out for trinkets. That, no, my yoni can heal.
Yeah.
I don't partake in that with just anybody. That's not worth it. But we just think that, you know, black women's collective
think it's just sex, and we just
right.
think, you know, I need a man. No, I'm not telling nobody not to have a husband or not to have a significant other. That couldn't be farther from the truth. But what I am saying is you have to be choosy about who you allow to come worship in your temple. And if he ain't worshiping, then he don't deserve to be in the vicinity of your damn
just
temple.
Just that simple.
Period. Period. You know, so that is what I'm saying. And the sisters need to get that. If you are by yourself at the moment, then it's a reason you by yourself. You go figure it out, you know. I happen to be single and by myself for the moment, and I'm loving it, you know. Yeah, I see some fine things walk past me, and I window shop from time to time, you know, looking at a. Yeah, I look. Because they be, you know, they be looking and smelling and woo, and then I have to testify. But I'm real. But I know what I'm trying to do. And I know that if a brother is not, if he doesn't really know truly who I am, he ain't even necessarily got to know the goddess stuff. But if he is respectful and he's not going to try to put me in my place, quote unquote, then I might get talked to the brother and school him. And if he open enough, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, but I'm not going to sit here trying to save nobody and trying to change him. I don't have time to change him because I'm too busy trying to change me because I need to figure out who and what I am so I can be the best me that I can be. I don't have time to change nobody else. And that includes everybody who's listening. I'm not, my goal, and don't get me wrong, but my goal is not to change y'all. My goal is to provide information for those who are searching for it. Because that's what, you know, this is the information I'm coming across because I'm in search of it. So please don't take me as this person that's high upon this pedestal or trying to get this information and people come to me looking at me as though I'm their teacher. I'm sharing information. Some people may consider me a teacher, but I'm sharing information. The same people that listen to me and participate with the website and everything, y'all help me out too because nobody knows everything. Nobody knows everything. So at the end of the day, you know, everybody who's sincere in searching for this information and knowing the truth, we share information. So just as much as I help you, you help me. But when it comes to the sex thing and the sexual energy, this is really what it's all about.
Especially if you have these younger generations, these girls that's coming up, you know, it's got to be a serious. You know, you got to more or less break the cycle with them, what they're seeing on the images that they're seeing on TV and even what they're, and not even what they're seeing on TV. Unfortunately, they're learning from, you know, their misguided, quote-unquote, mothers. You know,
hold on right
mothers.
While I still got control of the switchboard, I got to play something right quick because I think this is what I meant to play on a previous show, and I didn't have it loaded at the time where I had the wrong little snippet or song. So I'm going to play this right quick because I want to get y'all comments on it. Hold on right quick.
He was licking and sucking on everything, just the way he should. This morning's extra loving was good. We lay there, sweaty, sex funky, happy as we wanna be, loving exclusively, my man and me, all night, all morning, so our stomachs were growling hungrily. So I jumped up and rushed to the store, in hopes of coming back and getting a little more this morning. Loving. At the market, the people were pushing and shoving, trying to be the next in line. The turn was mine. The new girl at the counter was cute, not as fine as me. Was this some kind of women's intuition, some kind of insecurity? Nah, because my man is happy at home loving me exclusively. So I shook my head. What's up? Hello. She smiled. She hung me up. Orange juice, 329. Croissant, 485. She sniffed. Butter, 89 cents. She sniffed. Strawberries, $1.50 a pint. She sniffed and sniffed and sniffed and sniffed again and then replied, Raheem. Right.
Okay. Raheem, right. Y'all need to stop playing with these motherfuckers. Y'all need to stop playing and get serious. I'm trying okay. When I heard that, and by the way, that was Jill Scott, it's called Exclusively. It was real exclusive.
For her. One for him.
Yeah, one for him. Shit. Like I said, it all comes down to the original woman, the black woman. You need to know who and what you are by any means. I don't care what book is written in or who said it. It don't even matter. You just need to get the information. It doesn't matter where it comes from. We've had numerous shows giving books out, you know, but we have got to the first step is you have to pretty much erase everything that you have previously been taught. Because it's going to be real hard to accept some of this information if you do not have a clean and open mind. Because a lot of this stuff comes at you and it gets blocked. And I'm telling you this from experience because I'm still kind of grasping with certain types of things. And I'm like, okay, so where is this at? And I mean, you got to study it and you got to be willing to accept what you find as a result of your studies, even if it goes against what you previously thought. I mean, that's how any case study goes if you're doing it honestly. So that's all I'm going to say. I hope this information that we've shared and we've gone over tonight helps some sisters in their research. And stay tuned. Make sure you visit us on blackwomaniverse.com because we also do private sessions. And if you are not a part of blackwomaniverse.com, you would not get an email notification with the link for the private sessions. So definitely come on to the Black Womaniverse. And I give thanks to all the ancestral mothers that have left this information here and those that are working through us now to get us on the right path to finding out about who and what we are. And with that, I'm going to say peace and blessings, and thank you to everyone on the line, and I will talk to the sisters later.